guys? You have strength for a little bit of depth? Yeah? Are we awake? Okay, good. We have a basic question when we speak about Birkavot, which is a question that is deliberated by the commentaries, and that is, who is Birkavot talking to? Who is the target audience? Is Birkavot talking to the laymen? Or is Birkavot talking to the rabbis?
Everyone.
Is Birkavot telling us how every person must live their life? Or is Birkavot telling us, if you want to be a pious person, this is how you should live your life?
It's not both.
So that's, what?
It's not both. Cautious.
About his father,
it means like ethics from a father.
Right, which means he's talking to people who are going to pass on stuff to the future generations.
He's talking to all of us. It says, and it's starting with every chapter, all Israel has a share in the world to come. It reminds you that you should follow these ethics.
Okay, so let's start one step at a time. When do we read your Kabbalah?
We read
after Shabbos.
Okay, so on Shabbatot, during the summer months, starting from Pesach, going through Rosh Hashanah, till Sukkot basically, during the half of the year, that's the summer half of the year, we read Pirkei Avot and Shul after Mincha. Why? Okay, so one answer is that during the summer months, Ariel, during the summer months, we have a long Shabbos afternoon, right? Yes. So our sages didn't want the common folk. What are they going to do? They come to Yom Mincha, and after Mincha, they're going to go shoot the trees. They're going to go do nothing. They don't know what to do. So in ancient times, the rabbi used to give a lecture. That was the only time people would learn. And he'd give a 4 or 5 hour lecture with a lot of stories and a lot of halachot, helping the people know how to lead a moral and correct, halachically correct life. As times evolved, and people couldn't do that, so they instituted that during these long Shabbos afternoons, people would read Pirkei Avot. So Pirkei Avot teaches how to be moral, and obviously, there's definitely a message for each and every one of us in the Mishnayot. On the other hand, we have to recognize that there is a discussion about whether these Mishnayot are focused to the rabbis or to the common folk. Are they telling us how to be a decent person, or are they telling us how to be an exceptionally pious person? The question is, can I make a demand of someone to keep these halachot? We know that Shabbat we're all obligated to keep. Are we all obligated to be exceptionally kind? Or can we just be good, decent people, Jeremy? What do you say?
No, we should be exceptionally kind.
Yeah, you can expect. No. You can demand of every person to be exceptionally kind.
We have an obligation to be holy.
Oh, so on one level, we're all obligated to work our way up. But on the other level, the question is, can you make that demand of every person? When our Mishnah says, the men of the Great Assembly told us to be patient in judgment, the simple understanding is, it's in judgment. We're talking to the judges, we're talking to a rabbi, someone comes to... Someone comes before you and it's unclear, how to rule, so don't be quick to come to a conclusion. But the truth is, if we think about it, in all of our lives we have situations where we have to judge. You're at a storefront and the guy comes back and says, you know, you sold me a defective product. You have to call the shots on that. Two kids walk in and one is wailing, you know, my brother hit me. You have to call the shot on that. Throughout life, we do have to be judges. And this instruction that Chazal told us, be patient, take it easy. Don't be quick to come to judgment. That's a directive which we can all apply in our lives. Let's continue.
This is how it is.
What?
Deliberate
means that be patient. Wait, don't be quick to call the shot.
Many disciples.
Okay, theory, you want to expand on that?
Yes.
Where are we?
The Amidu Tamidim Harbe. Set up many, many disciples.
I'm sorry, but I can't.
Think about it for a minute. Nathan, what do you say?
I say.
Yeah, what do you say?
That
Develop any disciples, so you should develop any disciples.
Just a second, Daniel, when he finishes, I want to hear if you agree with him.
Me?
Daniel, why? Yes.
Daniel, why?
Yeah, so not many disciples, but you should have many followers so that you can spread the lore of the Torah. Like, if the more people you know, it's really the more people it's going to be passed down to. Like, if only a few people know, it's not going to be spread around that much. So that's why.
Okay, so wait, so Nathan, you're viewing this as a directive, like, on behalf of the Jewish people, spread the faith.
Spread the faith, not just to pass it down, but also so that they might lead ethical lives.
I think it's more for Jewish people.
Wait a second, Daniel, what do you say? You agree with him?
Yes, we stand, yeah.
The mission is now has established many students. We're going to hear you in a second, though. Yeah? It's also spelled W-E-I-L.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why stand here with 20 people? We're taking the simplest Mishnayot there are in Shas, the things that you guys can understand most easily. Why stand here with 20 people? Take the four that want to learn. Tell the others, go, have a good time. You won't learn. What's the point? Now, that's my question to you, because that's really what we're doing here, is we're fulfilling the Mishnah.
We should encourage them to learn.
Rabbi he said, if you want to enter the academy, you want to learn Torah, you got to prove you're worthwhile. So the person wanted to enter the academy, they persisted. What kind of person he was? They'd send investigators to check out how he was in business practices, if he was a decent person, an indecent person, and you know what? The academy numbered few people. There were a few people who were learning about Judaism, and the rest, they didn't know much. And then, at some point, they impeached him. They removed Rabbi Gamliel from the position of chief rabbi. He was very tough with a certain student, and the other rabbis decided he was too tough with that student, they removed him. So they removed Rabbi Gamliel from being chief rabbi, and they appointed a different chief rabbi. And when they appointed the other chief rabbi, named Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, he opened up the doors. He said, anyone who wants to come learn can come. We don't check after you. If when you're here, we discover that you're a thief, that you're going to use what you learn to harm other people, that you're an improper person, then we'll kick you out. But if you want to come in, we don't have to assume someone else is dead. The second you want to come learn, we open the doors of Torah to you. That's not midu talmidim avim. The Mishnah is telling us, make the Torah available to the masses. Make it available. So that's why we're recording while we're learning. You guys keep asking me, is this going on the way? Because there are a lot of people who don't have the opportunity you have to walk into here and learn. And the Mishnah directs us that we have to make Torah available to people. It's not the Torah is not given to the elite. There was once a rabbi who was walking and he sat down under a tree with to eat, and another guy sat down, a merchant came by, sat down with him, and they were eating together, Jeremy. And as they were eating together, the merchant asked him for words of Torah, And the rabbi saw that he didn't know anything, so the rabbi said, don't bother. So the merchant looked at him and said, you're a thief. So the rabbi asked him, why am I a thief? So the merchant said, because we say, Torah tzivah lanu Moshe, what's the end of the pasuk, Jeremy?
Which one?
Obviously Moshe.
Torah tzivah lanu Moshe, what do we say every morning? No one knows? No one knows the end of the pasuk.
That's true.
I mean, say the first
phrase,
I'll say the next one.
Torah,
yeah.
Tziva,
yeah.
Lanu,
yeah.
Moshe. Oh, what? What? Morashaki, Lat Yaakov. Very good, Josh. Morasha, what is the word Morasha?
No,
inheritance. Morasha doesn't literally, you're very, very close. Yerusha is an inheritance. Morasha, what is Morasha? It is all of our heritage. It is what we give over to the next generation. Jeremy, what are you going to give over to your kids? You know, a lot. Okay, so let's get something to give them. The merchant told the rabbi, he said, you can't tell me you're not teaching me Torah. It says Morasha, it belongs to all of us. It's all of our heritage. It's not yours. You can't say I'm not teaching you. And the rabbi accepted it. It's quoted in the Midrash, this story. So, V'amidu talmidim arbe, Nathan, why don't you summarize what we just said? Go ahead. Establish many students. Fire away.
We should learn the thing.
Daniel's going to listen here and fill in anything you leave out. Go ahead. Yes.
We should learn the Pirkei Avot so that we might pass them on to our children, as it's been done from the time that we got the Torah and the efforts of our fathers. Because they give a good grounding of how we should lead moral lives. This along with the Torah, and it gives a sense of continuity, how we should keep on passing on the message. And if Daniel Wilde would like to fill in the gaps.
I think it's pretty good, you're not sure.
Okay, so let's continue. So, the men of the Great Assembly, wait, who knows where they were historically, the men of the Great Assembly? Okay, so let's review history, guys. We'll begin with the beginning. God creates the world. We're all together? We're on the same page? I didn't hear what you said. I missed that. Slow down. Okay, so how many years ago was that? 5,769 years ago. So God creates the world. And, oh, what a good point. If we have time. I don't know if we're going to have a chance. I need to see. We'll discuss that.
Genesis and the Big Bang.
Okay. So let's continue. God creates the world. 10 generations from Adam till
Noah.
And Noah, we have what, Josh?
Flood.
What happens in Noah's time?
Noah.
Oh, very good. 10 generations later, what do we have? Tell us, Biri. Abraham. Very good. I don't know who Biri is.
Abraham.
Okay. Abraham has how many children?
Humor. Please, if you're going to say something funny, just say it yourself. If it's funny, in yourself, then you ask a friend and then say it. Yeah, you're right. You're joking.
This guy. This guy's the worst.
The truth.
If
he's saying it, the truth happens.
Maybe we should just go to RBM.
Yeah. Go to your friend. Find out if it's funny and then continue.
Okay, guys.
This is all going on the internet.
Right. RBM's going to sponsor you.
Okay. Amram has how many children? Ian, we haven't heard you. How many children does Abraham have?
He had two.
So we know he had one named Yitzhak, one named Ishmael, and he had many, many more, as is recorded in the Torah. Let's continue. Midian, Ba'ifah, Abizab, Izzah. Okay, but people don't know that. It's a good trick question. So Abraham has Yitzhak and Yaakov. Yitzhak has which children? Michael, Yitzhak has which children?
Yaakov and
Esau. Very good. Yaakov has which children? Help us out, Jordan, with how many children?
He has the 12 of them.
Binyamin, Joshua,
Okay, let's continue. Levi has a son named Amram. Levi has a daughter named Yocheved, and Yocheved has a son named Moshe. Moshe leads us out of Egypt. The year is 2448. Yaakov. Yaakov. Moshe's great grandfather, Yaakov. Moshe's great grandfather was Yaakov. Correct. Very good.
Through
his father, there was more. Through his mother, there weren't. Let's continue. His mother was a very, very old woman when she bore us. Moshe, you're right. There were four generations technically from Moshe to Yaakov through paternally. Okay, Biri, help us out. So Moshe takes the Jewish people out of Egypt in the year 2448. How many years are we in the desert?
40.
Wow, very good. Biri, you'll help me out on this one. Who leads the Jewish people after Moshe?
In the year 2448.
2448, we leave Egypt. The year 2488. We end our 40 years in the desert. Yes.
Josh.
Biri, Joshua, very good. Yeshua leads us into the land of Israel. When we're in the land of Israel, we spend quite a few hundred years until we build the first temple. Who builds the first temple?
Moshe.
Wait a second, Mikey, we haven't heard you for a while. Who builds the first temple?
Shlomo.
Very good. King Solomon builds the first temple. The first temple is erected for a few hundred years and is destroyed. The Jews are exiled to where? Tell us, Ariel. Where are the Jews exiled when the first temple is destroyed?
Exiled.
I can't hear Ariel.
I couldn't
hear the question. When the Jews are exiled at the destruction of the first temple, where are they exiled to? Very good. To Babylonia, which is overtaken by the Persian Empire. And then they come back to the land of Israel to rebuild the temple. When they come back, they are under the leadership of whom?
Victor.
You guys all heard the story. Oh, very good. So, Cyrus is the Persian king who is the son of Queen Esther. Queen Esther married Ahasuerus, or Xerxes had a child named Cyrus. He took over the Persian throne. When he took over the Persian throne, he sends his emissary. He's a Jew. His mother is Esther. He's Jewish. He sends Ezra to rebuild the temple. Ezra and Nehemiah, they come back. Most of the Jews do not want to leave Babylon. When they come into the land of Israel, they find that the Jews that have already made Aliyah are all intermarried. The Jews have intermarried. They don't keep Shabbos. They're doing business on Shabbos. Ezra says, you can't do this. What's going on here? Not allowed to intermarry, not allowed to do business on Shabbos. The people tell him, what do you mean we can't do business on Shabbos? Show us, where in the Torah does it say you can't do business? So no. Jeremy, where in the Torah does it say you can't do business? It doesn't. Good answer. You answered exactly. So it doesn't say in the Torah you can't do business, it's our tradition. And Daniel's going to help us out from here. So Ezra leads the Jewish people into the land of Israel. Daniel Diamond. How many people are the men of the Great Assembly, do you know?
20.
I didn't hear Daniel.
I actually heard it.
How many people are in the men of the Great Assembly? 72. 120. There were 71 in the Sanhedrin. There were 120 people together with Ezra, and they established things that changed the face of Judaism. They established Parashat Shmoneh Esrei. They established the concept of Muktzeh, that we don't carry around cell phones on Shabbos. They established the blessings the way we know them, and they gave us this directive which included three things. And those three things are Deen.
Things on here. Things on here.
What?
Dion.
Dion. What's your name? Dion. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Dion. What are the three things we just learned in the Mishnah?
You have to be deliberate in judgment, develop the disciples, and make a fence to the Torah.
Make fences to the Torah. Why did they say make fences? Because if you're going to walk around with your cell phone and say, I'm not going to answer, and then it rings on Shabbos, what are you going to end up doing?
Answering.
End up answering it. If you're going to walk around with
your cell phone.
Huh?
If you can't control yourself.
If you're not thinking, you walk around with the pen. You know how many times I'm sitting and learning? I have a pen right next to me on Shabbos. It's not in my hands. And I have a thought and I want to grab the pen and write something. The phone rings even when, how many times do you walk into the room and flip on the light and it's not even in your hands on Shabbos? So they said, one of the things they said was Muktzeh, but they also told us every person has to make a fence for himself. Gentlemen, question.
Sure.
Yes, Biri. Tell me, which mitzvah do you think is the most difficult mitzvah to keep?
That's 420.
I'm listening. Go ahead, Biri.
Most important one?
I didn't say most important. I said most difficult.
Oh, I'm saying the Sabbath, yeah.
Sabbath?
No.
Did you say Josh?
No.
Oh, I was wrong.
It's a different version.
I'd
say it's
1 second, 1 second. Think about it. What do you say?
Believe in God.
Shifting rabbis.
Guys, we're going around the room.
Ooh!
You're very close.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. No. Historically, that is one that has been very, very difficult. You're right.
If we ever have an opportunity, we'll discuss why. Yeah, Yoshua, it has to do with that we each have an ego, but it also has to do with the fact that we each feel very connected to the Torah. I'm telling you in a nutshell, and every person feels like, why should the rabbi tell me how to understand the Torah? What do you mean? I understand the Torah the way I understand. Why should he be telling me? And that stems from something that's very positive. It's because God created within each of us an intimate connection with the Torah. So it feels unnatural. Why should he be telling me? I feel so connected. Let me understand the Torah. Yeah, Yoshua, which mitzvah would you say is the most difficult to keep?
To judge everyone favorably.
Okay. It's not a direct mitzvah. It's a nice act of kindness. And that goes back to our first discussion today. Are these mishnayot obligatory, or are they just advice how to be an extra positive person? Yeah, Michael, go ahead. Which mitzvah? Lashon Hara, so the Jerusalem Talmud, it seems to say like you, that's like really, really difficult. Yeah, go ahead, Aria. We're getting back to you.
Think about it.
Go ahead, Josh, we're listening. Rich mitzvah. Which mitzvah do you think is the most difficult mitzvah? Why do you think Jeremy's going to answer that? Which mitzvah do you think is to you the most difficult mitzvah? So far we've heard Shabbos, respecting rabbis, and Lashon Hara. Jeremy, guys, let's respect one another. Jeremy, go ahead.
Need milk?
Need milk, really?
No.
What do you say, Ian?
Believing in God.
Yeah? That's so interesting. I wish we could talk about that.
Why didn't you say it?
There's nothing that's stopping. That's why we talk about.
I think we should cover the next two Mishnayot.
Internet.
Hi, Mom. Hi, Oli.
People,
you turn on the computer.
Is God.
Joshua, you just
all bow down to the Spirit.
In the Shulchan Aruch. In the Codex, it says that this generation.
Talk about 7 minutes.
In the Shulchan Aruch, it says, one of the most difficult mitzvot that we have is Kibbut Av Va'Em. What Daniel said is 100% on the mark.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
What did you say?
Yeah, Daniel died from molesting. Anyway, he opened it. To honor one's parents is a very difficult mitzvah. He is correct. Yes, Daniel Diamond, what are you going to say?
Papa, I'm being very lovely.
Yes, Daniel, what is
that?
Interesting, I hear. Go ahead, Jordan.
No.
Ian,
Riff,
like when you murder someone, you have to run away to the
next line.
I hear.
Yeah.
Treat other person like they are not the stranger.
We're
strangers in Egypt. So
I hear. What do you say?
No.
So let me tell you what I think is the most difficult mitzvah. I think the most difficult mitzvah is the mitzvah that the Torah tells us to constrain ourselves when it comes to relations with the other gender. I think that is the thing which most people have difficulty with. And that is one of the mitzvot which are also called a mitzvah hamura, a difficult mitzvah. And the question is, what do you do when you're contending with a difficult mitzvah?
A person decides he's going to take drugs. Then he discovers that the Torah doesn't allow you to take drugs. But by now he's addicted. What does he do? The Torah says you have to protect your life. You have to prolong your life. You're not allowed to do things that will shorten your life. Okay, so what do you do when you encounter a mitzvah that is difficult to keep? So our Mishnah answers that question. Our Mishnah says, who can figure out what the answer is from the Mishnah?
Build a fence.
Mikey, how does a fence help us? How does a fence help us keep a mitzvah?
A fence. Well, it's a fence.
It prevents us
from...
It's a
stable fence.
It's a metaphor.
I know, it's a metaphor that it's hard to break out of, which means that it's hard to transgress.
The idea of the fence is that I have the whole world. And this action, I'll fence in.
I have a problem with this whole fence in particular, right? That everything, the whole reason that God doesn't reveal himself, and he said that everything's meant to be a challenge, that makes our belief greater, the fact that we believe in Hashem greater, right? So then why don't we have enough free will to be able to resist the things that the fence is around? Like, for example, picking up a pen on shutters or whatever that is. You said we've been talking about how we've got free will, and that's why God doesn't reveal himself, and that's why it's a challenge to believe in Hashem, and that's why it's a challenge. Why do we need a fence? It's almost as if like we're protecting ourselves from free will. I mean, not from free will, but we don't have free will because we're protecting ourselves from.
So you still have the capacity to go over the fence. When they put a speed limit on the street, they know that if you go 5 miles above that, you won't kill yourself. But if you go 20 miles above that, you might.
So you're saying so it
makes it easier, right? It's like when
I want to ensure my son doesn't take the toilet bowl cleaner, right? Kids are into experimenting. So I put it on a high shelf, and I might lock that cabinet and ensure there's no access to it. There, I'm hypothetically away his free will because he can't really access it.
When he's a kid.
When he's a kid, right. Saying, right. But there are instances where you try to limit yourself. A guy's about to get drunk, he should give his keys to his wife. He wants to make sure he doesn't kill himself or anyone else.
Drinking can also not preserve.
That's also free will. The fact that I'm sure I will not have the capacity to sin is also free will. Right? I have the choice to ensure that I don't sin. It's an intelligent way to lead life. I mean,
imagine you bought a stock, right? You guys do a little bit of stocks?
Yes.
You bought a stock for $20, you got a hot tip, it's going to go up to 40 in 2 or 3 days. Now, if you're smart, you'll at least put in a sell order if it hits 18, 16, 15, 13. At some point, you will hit your bet, right? You'll put a sell order. Once it hits a certain price, you'll sell. Did you absolve your free will? No, you had the will, you had the right to protect yourself. So that's also a fence, right? Okay, let's learn the next Mishnah. Jeremy, if it's quick.
Quickly go back to this drug thing.
Yeah.
Doesn't drinking and smoking cigarettes also not prolong life?
Well, drinking can extend life. Depends on how much you're drinking and what
you can screw up your liver.
That's true.
And they've done new studies about how drinking can stuff you up.
For sure.
But it's still drinking.
I'm with you.
Saying whatever. I'm just like telling
you. And smoking, right? You're 100% right.
Yeah.
So
and a lot of religious Jews smoke cigarettes.
The issue is as follows.
It's because it's illegal.
No. Let's if you eat too many snacks, you could raise your cholesterol. At some point, we say you could do what you want. The Torah doesn't tell you you have to lead a life that's the most healthy life in the world. The Torah says you cannot do something which will directly harm your health. Meaning, a person's not allowed to slit his wrist. That we agree on, right? Wait, one step at a time. I can't do something that directly harms my health, right? A person's not allowed to cut himself, a person's not allowed to do things that will harm himself. to a point. I mean, that doesn't mean that every time I go out without gloves and my hands get all chapped, I'm sinning. It's not. But I'm still not supposed to harm myself. The greater the harm, the more incorrect it is of me. So far, we're on the same page?
Yes, also, yeah.
Okay, so the question is, at which point is it direct enough harm that it becomes prohibited? That's the halachic discussion. So some halachic authorities hold that it is prohibited to smoke. There's definitely an opinion that as information has come out, as we know more about smoking, there are more and more halachic authorities that prohibit it. There are still those opinions that say it hasn't yet crossed the threshold of being direct enough harm that it's different than eating a cholesterol or eating all the fat in your chicken or other things. So drugs, I think, is more direct. I think that I know from the research I did. Again, my research is about 15 years old. When I was teaching in high school, about 15 years ago, then I did research on drugs, and at the time, the information available, the harmful effects of drugs were more direct.
I really feel like some issue interpretation of this kind of issue.
I guess you might be able to argue that with maybe with marijuana. Maybe. I don't think you could argue that with other forms of drugs. I mean, even on marijuana, you have to remember, if a person is going to get on a roller coaster and not seatbelt himself, and I'll say, but for the first 10 minutes, it doesn't go upside down, I'm fine. You'll agree with me that if after 10 minutes he ends up falling out of the roller coaster and dying, he kills himself.
I'm not going to get being alcoholic.
No. Okay, two things. A, there's a difference between a glass of wine every so often and the person who goes out and buys a thing of wine. And the question is statistically, when people start with marijuana, where do they end up? Meaning, is it like getting on that roller coaster? It's only a matter of time before they're going to end up doing other things and killing themselves. Or severely harming.
You're also showing different things. Yeah, like focusing on drugs, obviously, because it's illegal, but I'm saying other things as well are showing that to yourself.
So I'm saying that's where the discussion revolves around. That's what it revolves around. I hear what you're saying. I'm just saying I'm not so sure that even if you could prove to me that marijuana is not harmful.
I'm just the whole idea of it, not necessarily drug use.
Marijuana is what I thought.
Okay, let's continue. Mishnah Beis. Who's going to volunteer to read Mishnah Beis? Nathan, go ahead. You read. Mikey's going to translate. Unless you wish to switch before he reads your translation.
I'll read the Hebrew stuff.
Go ahead. Mishnah Beit. Mishnah Beit, the second Mishnah. Ian, I want you to think. I'm
going to
ask you for insight. Go ahead.
Shimon Hasidic Ahaya Mashre.
Yeah, Mishre.
Chaneset.
Yes, Mikey, we're listening.
Shimon the Righteous was among the survivors of the Great Assembly.
Okay. Ian, you want to explain?
I'm assuming that when we were exiled from Israel, of the 120 people from the Great Assembly.
Remember, wait. So the 120 people were when we came back. They led us, they were the leaders when we came back to the land of Israel to rebuild the second temple. Yeah.
Guys,
I can't hear him. What?
Most of them passed on, died, and only a few were survivors, and Shimon the Righteous, Shimon HaTzadik, was still alive.
Right, can you explain to me, Ian, why is he called the Tzadik?
Why is he the Tzadik? Because he did the right thing, I guess. He was learning Torah, he was serving God, and he always looked out for the right thing, always took the right path.
Right, but we will encompass the whole tractate, I hope, during the course of the next 2 months. And we will not encounter another rabbi who is called Tzaddik. He is the only one. So then there must be something exceptional about him that he is called Tzaddik, no?
He was right.
The other ones were not Tzaddik?
No.
He was just better.
What?
He was just better.
So you're saying he was just better. Okay. Yeah.
He came back.
Didn't he stop at his own?
Oh, wow.
No, he didn't
nice.
Stop Alexander the Great. He made a deal with Alexander the Great so that boys could still be circumcised and brought into the Torah. And
you know the story?
Alexander the Great came and he conquered Israel, but he didn't stop the Jews from doing what they wanted.
I hear. We have only 2 minutes left, and I'd much rather try to finish the Mishnah, at least superficially, and we'll try to get more depth next week. So let's continue. Yeah, Nathan. The second was Huayamir, mean Mikey?
Huayamir, he used to say.
What, you want to expand on that, Ian?
Used to say.
Means what?
Means that in the past, he would say.
No. I didn't stop. I'm not wasting our time. He used to say means, they said many things. This was a common saying then. He used to frequently say this. That's what Huayamir meant.
Whenever he changed the opinion, why would you say, what could he say? He would say,
Huayamir used to mean that he would perpetually. It's like your mother has her sayings.
Does that mean 10 years later his opinion changed?
No, it means that. This is an important point because when we're going to read throughout the Mishnayot, so and so used to say, it means he taught many things. We're going to encounter these people throughout Mishnayot. But this is the one saying that he used to say frequently, or the few. Yeah, Nathan, go ahead. Let's finish the Mishnah. Yeah, Mikey, we're listening.
Sorry, the world depends on three things: on Torah study, on the service of God, and on kindness.
Okay, so, gentlemen, I have a question. Why is Torah study so important? We say the world stands on it. Why?
Now the Torah dictates the way we should live our lives.
Well, when I asked you guys to tell me at the beginning of class, 60 seconds of what's included in the Torah, you guys didn't tell me so much about what the Torah tells me how to lead our lives. So I'm asking you, why is Torah study so important?
It tells us how to better our lives.
What do you say, Jeremy? Why is Torah study so important? Yeah, Jeremy, the other Jeremy, why is Torah study so important?
To understand this through narrative, through narrative, through different stories, it gives us, you know, morals and allows us somewhere through laws, through direct worship of God, other times through stories. It gives us some sort of structure or foundation.
And is that better than the way other people live their lives? You see Jews being happier?
No.
Why do I need the Torah?
No, people sacrifice. There's no sense of absolute morality in this world. And that's
wait. You leaped 10 steps forward. Yeah, I'm listening. You want to explain that? What does that mean, absolute morality?
That there's one governing morality. That's not what I think is wrong, what you think is wrong. The Torah claims that its morality is a supreme or some sort of supreme.
Dean, did you hear what Jeremy just said?
Yeah, I did.
And what do you have to add, detract, agree or disagree?
No, I think...
I necessarily agree with that.
You do or don't? Why?
Because I think it's troublesome to assume that it has absolute right. That there's one governing, there's one concept of what is good that comes from this part.
So there are...
Because that goes back to the assumption that God is inherently good. And I start with that assumption as well.
Okay, so that's where we'll have to begin our discussion next week. So we will start Bezrat Hashem with this point next week.
1-0-0-1-0-1-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0